Thank you very much. I would like to express my deep gratitude and pleasure to David Gross and the Kavli Institute of Theoretical Physics for extending me this invitation. This is a distinguished place with a lot of important work being done in theoretical physics. You're stealing people away from Caltech. It is wonderful to be in Santa Barbara, especially since only 2 years ago my daughter completed her education here, and I'm grateful to be here. It is an honor to speak here because I'm a historian at a place where most lectures are devoted to exoplanets, to black holes, string theory, and quantum information. I am not a physicist by training. I was trained as a physical chemist. And so the discussions, the technical discussions of physics, will be restrained to certain aspects of the history of physics in the 19th and 20th century. So the photograph of Albert Einstein on a bicycle is well known to many people, but is usually misattributed to having been taken on the campus at Caltech. This photograph was taken right here in Santa Barbara. Let's see if this works. Does it work? So Einstein was a visiting scientist at Caltech for 3 semesters in the early 1930s. And he appears, for example, up there in the capital of the South Houses, student houses, playing his violin. But the famous photograph was taken right here in Santa Barbara at the home of Ben Meyer. The home was built by Gordon Kaufman, who also designed buildings at Caltech, and therefore the misattribution. So this picture was taken in 1933. Meyer was a wealthy trustee of Caltech who had invited Einstein to Santa Barbara. You can see him here in a postcard taken only a couple of years earlier with Winston Churchill, who over only 20 minutes had reeled in 188-pound marlin at the Tuna Club on Catalina Island. Einstein had visited Santa Barbara already a year earlier, in February 1932. And we know from a letter that was sent to Einstein upon completion of his visit to Santa Barbara by Ludwig Kast, who was president of the Macy Foundation, which is a foundation extending grants to scientists, that Einstein visited some 10 homes in Santa Barbara and Montecito area. And among them was Casa Dorinda, inhabited by the widow of the recently deceased William Henry Bliss, vice president and general solicitor of the Duluth and St. Paul Railroad. And in her expansive home and music room, Mrs. Bliss entertained the King and Queen of Belgium, who were no mean musicians and would play music with Einstein in Europe, as well as Jan Paderewski, the pianist, composer, and second prime minister of the Republic of Poland, and Jascha Heifetz, the preeminent violinist of the 20th century. Now this estate, some of you probably know, is a retirement community. Einstein also visited Valverde Estate, designed between 1915 and 1935 by Bertram Goodhue, another Caltech architect, and Lockwood DeForest. And the owner of this estate was the free-thinking Wright Ludington, at the time when Einstein visited the estate, only 30 years old. Ludington had 3 or more major fortunes, but mindful that his laws in his home state of Pennsylvania outlawed his homosexuality, he moved to California. And Ludington amassed a significant collection of paintings of Picassos and Derains and Juan Miró, and Dalí, among others, and they are now housed at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. The majestic estate in Montecito was only recently, I found out, listed for $16 million just a few weeks ago and sold in 2 weeks. And Einstein also visited this place, Miraflores, the former Santa Barbara Country Club, owned by Mr. and Mrs. John Percival Jefferson, and he visited at least 7 other homes. So to understand this extraordinary intense schedule of visits, most likely executed over less than 48 hours by Einstein in Santa Barbara, is to understand, I would say, both Einstein the phenomenon in 1932-33 when he visited California, but also to understand the culture of science and the culture of California at the time. But how does one write the history of such a phenomenon? Should we hit the various landmarks in his life, biographical, scientific, personal, professional? Or should we immerse ourselves and Einstein in the historical context of the time? Should we see Einstein as originating everything, as initiating everything? Or should we see him as somebody who was responding, reacting to events, propositions, requests, invitations, and provocations in his life? So although there are numerous Einstein biographies in print, I would like to submit to you that none of these biographies was ever written by a professional historian or historian of science. There are more biographies of Einstein than of Luther. Beginning in the early 1920s, and not one single one of them was written by a professional historian or historian of science, and there are good reasons for that, and I can discuss them in the Q&A. All of them were written either by journalists or by people who were personally involved with Einstein, people who were distant members of his family, scientists who had worked with Einstein, philosophers who had worked with Einstein, such as Philip Frank and Abraham Pice. These are important methodological questions that I could raise for the professional academic historian. They are of great interest, but given the time constraints and the scope of this talk and the request that I give a non-specialist talk, I will leave them aside for today, although I hope to illustrate with some concrete examples that are following how rooted Einstein's trajectory was in the economic, political, social, intellectual history of Europe, Germany, and the United States in the 20th century. What groups did Einstein belong to? What networks did Einstein belong to? How his circles of connections, his Facebook, changed over time? These are concepts that historians use. We talk about homophily, the belongings, and I hope to just illustrate, even if I cannot analyze, the complexity of Einstein's historical rootedness. The distinguished European visiting professor at the beginning of the century was already a well-established tradition in the United States. At Caltech, Robert Andrews Millikan, who had studied in Leipzig and Göttingen and Berlin and had moved to California, introduced the visiting professor phenomenon to Caltech. He invited people like Arnold Sommerfeld, Henrik Anton Lorenz, Paul Ehrenfest, who preceded Einstein in their visits to California. But already Ludwig Boltzmann, the famous atomist, founder of statistical mechanics, some say inventor of quantum theory in a way, in terms of Tom Kuhn argues that, had visited America several times, starting in the late 1890s, first visiting the famous St. Louis World Fair and Exhibition, where scientists gave very important talks about the future of physics in 1894, and famously some of them said, the only thing that is left over for physicists to do is to calculate things to the fourth digit. How wrong did they turn out to be? within 12 months with the discovery of X-rays by Röntgen, the discovery of radioactivity by Becquerel and Curie in 1896, the discovery of the electron in 1897, everything that was said in St. Louis was wrong. So Boltzmann came to the United States and wrote a very amusing memoir of his visit to Berkeley, his third to the United States, a German professor's voyage to the El Dorado, a humorous depiction of his traveling across the US continent, arriving by train in Berkeley, where the students were wonderful, I quote, and bright and lively, and there were lots of girls, but they did not master differential calculus. And where he had the luxury of having an ensuite heated bath at the Cloyne Hotel, which was Cloyne Court Hotel. He too was entertained memorably, like Einstein, but this is 35 years earlier, by Mrs. Phoebe Apperson Hurst, the benefactor of Berkeley, in her dining and music room at the Hacienda del Pozzo de Verona, a 53-room estate outside Pleasanton in the Livermore Valley. And she fed him oatmeal with pineapple, which horrified him, but he had to comply, and asked him to perform on an extraordinary Steinway concert grand piano, which Boltzmann had only seen at the Philharmonic in Vienna and in Berlin. Nobody in a private home had such a piano in Germany at the time, or Austria. Unfortunately, Boltzmann, who was very happy to return to Germany that summer, committed suicide, some say because of the pressures put upon his great advocacy of the atomic theory, some because of the difficulties with overwork. But beyond offering you these tidbits of entertaining California history, I do like you to get a glimpse of the academic life of prominent scientists. Germany at the beginning of the 20th century was the mecca of science. Everybody was going to study at German universities. They came from the United States, from Russia, and from the Far East. The centrality of Germany in training and expansion in all scientists cannot be overstated, and a postdoctoral year in Germany between 1880 and 1930 was de rigueur for all aspiring young American scientists. And this had happened in particular as a result of work done by this man, Abraham Flexner, who wrote a famous book in 1908, The State of the American College, in which he lambasted the teaching, the poor teaching of American students, the university lecture as a method of instruction, handling cheaply massive amounts of students, and allowing the professor to engage in research without devoting any time or effort to instructing students in research. So the research model, both in experiment and theory, had been modeled by people like Boltzmann, by Lorentz, Sommerfeld, Planck, and so on. Here is Planck, a theoretical physicist who had started out in physical chemistry, actually, and thermodynamics, and had experience with laboratory work. And I'm bringing him up not only because of his great achievements and his great productivity and the many books that he published, as you can see on the left, but because they set the model of the engaged professor. And when I say engaged professor, I mean the professor who was producing not only numerous research papers, textbooks, collections of articles, even autobiographical essays, addresses, newspaper articles, popular scientific writings. These men rose to positions of great importance and significance in German science. Not only because they accepted to work as leaders of their institutions, but also to build new institutions devoted to research, such as the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, now the Max Planck Institutes at the beginning of the 20th century. They sat as editors of prestigious journals, such as the Annalen der Physik, do I have that? No, I don't. Where Paul Drude and then Max Planck reigned supreme as editors. They did not go through peer review process at the time. They put their imprimatur on every paper. They read every paper very carefully. And they set examples. They presided over scientific societies, academies, prizes, fellowships. They raised money and engaged in that peculiar relationship between government, industry, and academia that made Germany and Austria the center of the scientific world before the arrival of Adolf Hitler. So Einstein, whose 133rd birthday we celebrate today, is now, unfortunately, only universally remembered as the wise, old, goofy, disheveled man. We do not associate him to these great builders of science. But we do have to understand that he was their colleague, and I hope to show you that he himself also followed the model of the engaged professor, a model that was very important to the later development of science, in particular in California, as we saw at Berkeley, Stanford, Santa Barbara, Caltech, and other institutions that did not exist before the end of the 19th century. So how this persona of Einstein, of the disheveled, confused, sockless, theoretical physicist with his head in the clouds with a pencil and paper emerged, can be seen here already in 1932 at an issue of Forbes magazine, exactly at the time that Einstein was in California and in Santa Barbara. This issue was celebrating the new science, and you see right here, the Mount Wilson Observatory, new galaxies, but you already see Einstein in the middle of atoms as the iconic caricature that we still preserve today. And moreover, nobody knew how to capitalize on this media frenzy more than the American press. The American press covered Einstein's three visits to California daily, whether the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Times, or the Pasadena Star News had absolutely daily articles on Einstein. They followed his every step, in particular the first year. So to foreshadow the rest of my talk, I wish to argue that as early as the immediate post-World War I months, Einstein became a singular public personality of profound symbolism and significance, but that the 90 years since then have erased the significance of Einstein and these symbols with which he was invested by the scientific community and by the press, by politicians and by the general public, and that the Einstein that we think we know today is really not the same as the one that we are celebrating. So this emergence of Einstein on the world scene had many deleterious repercussions on his own life, actually, to his own private and his professional life, but they also allowed him to engage in what were to be important public activities. So the title of today's talk is drawn from a letter by Einstein that we are publishing right now. We're finalizing the 13th volume in the collected papers, a letter that was written in the summer of 1922 to a very close friend and confidant, the Swiss forensic pathologist and doctor Heinrich Zanger in Switzerland. And he writes, "Worship today, scorned or even crucified tomorrow, that is the fate of people whom, God knows why, the bored public has taken possession of." So for the rest of my talk, I would like to trace the story of how Einstein became one of these people whom the public has taken possession of. Einstein himself participated in the process of becoming a public figure. He did not allow the press and the public to completely take take hold of him and used to joke about it just like this. This is also a cartoon that appeared in the United States while he was in California. How is it that nobody understands me and everybody likes me? The implication being that he's a more complicated and less likable person than the cartoons make him out to be. So let's start with the beginning. Einstein was born in Wilhelmine, German Empire, and he lived in Europe through World War I, through the Weimar Republic, through Nazism, and the rise of Hitler, before spending the last third of his life in the US during World War II and the early decade of the Cold War. This was not an easy life, and it stretched six important historical periods. He led a peripatetic existence his entire life. He was born, that went way too fast. He was born in Ulm, a small town in southern Germany in 1879. And his family moved to Munich when Einstein was 1 year old, where he attended his schooling actually from a very young age. His mother wrote that she would let Einstein cross the street and go to daycare at age 2 to make sure that he becomes an independent young boy. He started school early and he jumped ahead. He attended gymnasium or high school in Munich, the Bavarian capital, a very interesting and upcoming place, which had been rather provincial at that time. And then he ran away during his last year in high school to Pavia, where his family, his father and uncle, were trying to establish an electrotechnic company, which was their specialty. Einstein did not want to become an engineer, but nevertheless, his favorite school was the ETH in Zurich, the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule. He had to spend 1 year to finish his high school education outside of Zurich in a small liberal private school before registering as the youngest student ever admitted to the ETH. Now, the ETH was modeled on the École Polytechnique, the famous Grandes Écoles established by Napoleon at the end of the 18th century to train scientists and engineers who would become the leaders of French society and of the French Republic, which Napoleon obviously afterwards betrayed by crowning himself emperor. Nevertheless, the great schools survived, the École Polytechnique, the École Normale, and they trained the people who built bridges and canals, but also the French administration. And to this day, they are the most coveted schools where philosophers and humanists are nevertheless trained in mathematics and physics, such as the famous philosopher Emil Bergson, who was to be one of Einstein's most avid readers. Einstein received only one position after he completed his PhD in 1902, and that was the spending of 7 years in Bern as a patent clerk. I'll get back to that. He then was a professor in Prague and in Zurich before finally joining the Prussian Academy of Sciences in Berlin the day before World War I broke out. And then came to Princeton in October 1933. Now, Einstein was a happy, self-possessed young child. And we know a lot about his childhood from letters, for example, by his grandparents that have never been published. We also know about his childhood from Maya, his younger sister. She was 3 years younger. They are here dressed up for a bal masqué. And she wrote a biography of Einstein much later in the 1920s, from which there are oft misunderstood reminiscences about him. he was an excellent pupil, and you can see him here with his classmates sometime at age 8 or 9. Whoops. He is the only smiling child. At the time when children were supposed to sit very still and be very serious and look very much like adults in school. This is a mixed grade class. And you can see he's one of the smallest and the youngest children because indeed he jumped ahead. His final high school examination in Switzerland at the school gave him grades from 3 to 6, and despite the fact that already, as Dr. Gross mentioned, 35 years ago, the first volume of the Einstein Papers gave a complete account of Einstein's accomplishments as a young student, there is still the oft-peddled myth that Einstein got terrible grades while he was in high school. In Germany, the high school grades ranged from 1 to 6, with 1 the best grade and 6 the worst grade. So by this account, indeed, Einstein would have pretty bad grades. But we have tried repeatedly to tell the story that in Switzerland, which has a love-hate relationship with Germany, the grades had been changed at the end of the 19th century, and 6 is the best grade and 1 is the worst grade. So Einstein did very well in all the scientific fields. His worst grade was in French, a language that he only studied for 8 months before taking his exam. But it is actually in this short French examination that we have the first essay that tells us that Einstein was interested in science. So in this French essay for the Matura, Mes projets d'avenir, my projects for the future, Einstein says, I want to be a theoretical physicist and I want to study the most important things about the nature of force and light. That was written on one page. That only earned him the grade of 3. He was the youngest student, as I mentioned, who was admitted to the ETH, where he studied more than 12 hours of electrical and mechanical laboratory every week of every year during 4 years. So there were 12 hours of laboratory practice as a student at the ETH. Even though he did not want to be an engineer, he wanted to be a physics teacher. So there were 2 paths at the ETH. There was the teacher path and the engineering path, and he wanted to be a teacher. So he had 12 hours of laboratory work, and we have here his lab book for his first course during the class of Heinrich Weber, whose work later became very important for Einstein because Weber was the man who measured the electrical resistance of carbon filaments for bulbs, for light bulbs. That work became fundamental when Einstein published in 1906 his paper on the quantum theory of solids, and it's the only paper that has a graph of data in Einstein, the only paper ever to have data. The data was from Weber, and it showed that specific heats of solids, not just of gases, drop significantly towards low temperatures. In any case, another thing that was important at the ETH was that nobody taught Maxwellian electrodynamics. Einstein never had a course in Maxwell. A lot of the important things that he had to learn to lead to his famous papers of 1905, he learned by himself. He studied by himself, as we know from his correspondence with his sweetheart, girlfriend, and college classmate, Mileva Maric. He was unable to obtain more than temporary work as a physics and mathematics teacher in high schools. He was a substitute teacher. He did private tutoring, and eventually a friend's father obtained for him a position as a technical expert third class at the Office of Intellectual Property in Bern. It was called intellectual property 100 years ago. Einstein did not have to decide whether a patent has priority over any other invention. The only thing Einstein had to decide was whether the submitted project worked, whether the device that was put in front of him worked. And he always acknowledged that these 7 years at the patent office were extremely creative for him, that they were that secular cloister where I hatched my most beautiful ideas. The office allowed him to have a decent income and to rent an apartment for his young family, his wife Mileva Maric, and his son who was born 3 years later, his first son Hans Albert Einstein. The relationship with Mileva Maric was a difficult one. It had been going on for a while. Einstein's family was opposed to this relationship. Mileva was many years older, slightly physically impaired, and Einstein only married her after the death of his father, who apparently on his deathbed gave him a blessing to marry her. And now we come, of course, to the famous papers of 1905. And even though I cannot go into each of these papers, what I'd like to say is that they did not spring out of his head unprepared and new from a vacuum. Einstein, by 1905, had already published quite a lot. Important papers on molecular forces. He had designed on paper and in the laboratory and in his own head all sorts of experiments, very similar to the Michelson-Morley experiment, very similar to the Fizeau experiment. So in addition to the five miracle year papers, as we call them, I'd like to mention that he had written that year 9 reviews for the Beiblätter für Physik on many topics in physics. His total output for the year 1905 exceeded 25 papers. And this rate of 2 papers per month, which he began at the age of 26, Einstein maintained throughout the rest of his life. So between 1905, more or less, and 1950, for half a century, Einstein produced 2 pieces of writing per month. He was an extremely disciplined writer. So that now we have in our archive some 1,000 writings produced by Einstein, in addition to thousands of pages of calculations and unpublished drafts and notes. The next 10 years of Einstein's life, by his own account, were of course the most strenuous years of his life as he struggled with the incorporation of gravity into his theory of relativity. He was soon aware that empirical observations were needed, as he wrote in 1913 to George Ellery Hale, who was one of the founders of Caltech, and of course of the famous Carnegie Observatories on Mount Wilson. And already in 1913, a few years after formulating the important principle of equivalence, Einstein wrote to Hale asking him whether he believes that the falling of light or the deflection of light by a heavy gravitational object could be observed during daylight. And Hale actually answered immediately to Einstein and said, "No, unfortunately, we do not have any tools by which we can observe the deflection of light or light particles falling in the gravitational field of a heavy object." What I'd like you to look here, and we'll get back to this, is this value of 0.84. This value is 0.84 arc seconds. It is the Newtonian value, or what we call the half value of light bending, which Einstein was to revise, of course, to its double as he developed the theory of relativity. In 1905, he became an assistant or Privatdozent in Bern. So this was his first academic position, more or less between an instructor and an assistant professor, and he was 30 years old already and had published all this work. But eventually he received a position at the University of Zurich a year later and started to lecture on electrodynamics and relativity theory and began to appear on the world stage. So that in 1909, he participated in a very important meeting in Salzburg of the German Society of Natural Scientists, where he gave important papers and where he met another extremely talented relativist, Fritz Hasenerl, whose career would probably have developed in parallel with Einstein and would have been a great collaborator had he not been killed a few years later on the front during the First World War. He then proceeded and lectured also in Leiden, and he lectured, he visited Arnold Sommerfeld and many other scientists, and he discussed his work, and he discussed both radiation theory and relativity and the generalization of relativity. Still, in 1911, he moved to Prague, and this was his first full position as a professor of theoretical physics at the German University in Prague. There were two universities in Prague, the Czech University and the German University. He was in Prague for less than a year. Prague was at the time still part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His appointment had to be approved by the Emperor of Austro-Hungary, for which he had had to go and have an interview a few months earlier in Vienna. He gave a lot of talks in Vienna, including one on the influence of gravity on the propagation of light. And we know quite a bit about Einstein's daily life and his scientific preoccupations because we have something like this, Einstein's little scratch notebook, dated to about 1911 to 1913. It's a very nice leather-bound black book in which Einstein wrote, not always in chronological order, both scientific ideas, notes for his laboratory courses, experimental results, books he was reading, books that he should read, and experiments that he was conducting with his students once he became a professor. And we know some very interesting things. So on this page here, on the right, we see a schedule of Einstein's visits to Berlin in April 1912, where he went and visited Warburg and Nernst and Freundlich and other important physicists. Emil Warburg, talking about the Kavli Institute seminar, had instituted, together with Rubens before him, a very famous Wednesday afternoon colloquium, where every physicist in town would attend these Wednesday afternoon colloquia. They set the tone for research talks. He discussed with Erwin Freundlich heat radiation, photochemistry. He discussed low temperature physics, which had just been discovered in 1911, 1912 in the laboratory of Heike Kamerling-Onnes in Leiden. Superconductivity was being discovered at the same time, a most extraordinary phenomenon that nobody understood for the next 22 years. But he also apparently discussed gravitational lensing. This is a discovery that was made by the editors of the Einstein Papers Project several years ago while examining this notebook. And since then, we have made a little more discoveries about this. So this most important tool of modern astronomy was envisaged by Einstein in April of 1912. On April 14, the Titanic sank, and that is more or less the day that Einstein arrived for his one-week visit in Berlin with Rubens and Warburg and Freundlich. And we have learned from recently discovered letters that we published in volume 12 that Einstein investigated the idea that stellar lensing might explain the phenomenon of new stars. and that he gave up this idea after looking more closely at the characteristic features of Nova. So let me tell you that, in March 1912, something happened in the sky. The Nova Geminorum appeared, and it was very bright, and its brightness declined, but there was still a peak during the week that more or less that Einstein was in Berlin, and then it declined rapidly. Scientists took spectra measurements of the Nova Geminorum, and here we have the spectra between April 6 and March 22 that Einstein probably discussed at the Potsdam Observatory, the Sternwarte, at which Erwin Freundlich was an astronomer. And he gave back, he went back with these calculations and then changed his mind. He realized that the nova was a phenomenon all in itself, and that gravitational lensing was not explaining the brightness of the star by looking at the spectra. Einstein eventually published on gravitational lensing in 1936, this famous little note. So this appeared 25 years after he had thought about it. And then only at the instigation of a Czech engineer, Fritz Mandl, who wrote to Einstein saying, isn't it possible that there is such a thing as gravitational lensing? And Einstein, like Richard Feynman, said, oh, well, I calculated it. I might just as well publish it. So why didn't Einstein publish for 25 years about gravitational lensing when, in fact, he had calculated? And on the next pages, there are 8 pages of calculations. He had calculated the magnification. He had calculated the size of the rings. The order of magnitude was correct. Everything in 1912, 1913, we have letters that he wrote to Emil Bude that we discovered 2 years ago. Why didn't he do anything about it? Because he understood that it cannot be used. And we have letters. So here comes a very important caveat that I will repeat. The theory of relativity, and much related to general relativity, was of no use to physicists until the 1950s and 60s, and John Wheeler, and important instruments, and Hubble telescope, and so on. So one has to understand why quantum mechanics becomes so hot and so important, nuclear physics, particle physics in the 1920s and 30s, and why relativity is in a quiet period until the 1960s. And Einstein understood that. So diverse and far-reaching were Einstein's preoccupations at the time that we have to return now to the year 1911, when Einstein for the first time participated at a meeting of the top scientists in Europe at the time. The most pressing issue in 1911, 5 years after the equivalence principle, 6 years after the 1905 papers, was the so-called ultraviolet catastrophe concerning the discrepancy between theory and measurement for the heat radiation of a black body. The Rayleigh-Jeans law describing such radiation agrees with experimental results at large wavelengths or low frequencies, but strongly disagrees at short wavelengths, high frequencies. And this inconsistency between observation and the predictions of classical physics is known as the ultraviolet catastrophe, and its resolution was brought about by the postulation in early 1900 of Max Planck of what we call the older classical quantum theory, a quantum hypothesis. And this hypothesis was discussed a lot during a week of meetings that took place at a conference called together by the physical chemist Walter Nernst and the industrialist Ernest Solvay in 1911. So David Gross played a central role in more than one way at the latest celebrations of the 100th anniversary of this famous Solvay meeting that took place at the Hotel Metropole in Brussels. You see here a postcard from the time of the hotel, where the famous photograph of Einstein with Marie Curie, Paul Langevin, Henrik Anton Lorentz. Here's Marie Curie, Paul Langevin, Lorentz, Solvay, Lorentz, Nernst. There are other important people here, James Jeans. There is Einstein. Took place, a small meeting devoted to the discussion of a single scientific topic, a meeting that Einstein thought was entirely useless because nothing new was said at the Solvay conference. He said, "I knew everything. It all resembled a lamentation at the ruins of Jerusalem." He said it was a witch's Sabbath the diabolical Jesuit fathers would have had. So he thought it was what we often think about scientific conferences. Nevertheless, the proceedings of this conference were published and were edited by a most remarkable young man on the rise at the time, Maurice de Broglie, who was to make important contributions to the resolutions of the problems related to quantum mechanics, and by Paul Langevin, and all these people here, Poincaré may be excluded, Perrin, Brillouin, Langevin, Curie, and de Broglie were to become lifelong friends and colleagues of Einstein, and they accompanied each other through very difficult political and personal times. Einstein was invited to participate in all subsequent Solvay conferences in physics, and it is in this capacity as representative of the German physics community that he elicited the ire of his German colleagues in the post-World War I period. So we were discussing earlier as to whether scientists at these meetings represent themselves or whether they represent their home communities, their institutions, or their countries. And in the 1910s and 20s and 30s, it was clear to these people that they represented more than just themselves. And there were prices to pay and political burdens to carry along in the decision whether to attend or not such meetings. And they were seen as representing their nations, even in that small European context. Fritz Haber.
21.
That's what I'm. That's why it's in gray. And this is where I'm getting as to why Einstein did not go. As to what? I think gravity is taking control of the. It's going lower and lower. As to why Einstein did not go to the 1921 Congress. Fritz Haber, Einstein's close friend, who was chiefly responsible for creating a position for Einstein in Berlin before the war, was very unlike Einstein in all aspects. Haber, a converted Jew, a nationalist, and a patriot, had supported Germany's war aims and had participated most notoriously in the development of chemical gas warfare. So much so that after World War I, he was on a list of enemy aliens to be apprehended by the Allied forces. When Einstein, at the last minute, decided not to participate in the 1921 Solvay Conference, and instead traveled to the United States with a delegation of British Zionists, hoping to raise money for the yet-to-be-established Hebrew University in British Mandate Palestine, Haber admonished Einstein in a letter that wounded Einstein deeply. So please allow me to read the letter to you. I'm putting it up there. "Dear Albert Einstein," this is very formal, they were very good friends, "our many years of friendship compel me to write you today I am told that you are soon to depart for the United States on behalf of efforts to establish a Zionist university in Jerusalem, and that you are undertaking this trip in the company of English supporters of this idea, and are afterwards also going to stay in England at the invitation of the government over there. From the papers, I found out, in addition, that this plan prevents you from attending the Solvay conference in Brussels, to which you have been invited as the only representative of our country. If you travel to America at a moment when the new president of the United States is delaying the consultations on the law through which the peace between the United States and Germany is to be declared, so the United States Congress did not ratify a peace agreement with Germany until 1922, 4 years after the end of the war. If you travel with English Friends of Zionism at a moment when the sanctions are exposing more starkly than ever the contrast between England and us, then you are publicly proclaiming before the whole world that you do not want to be anything but a Swiss who by coincidence has his residence in Germany. We'll read one more thing and then we'll stop with details. Einstein replied that same day, March 9th, "Despite my declared international mentality, I do still always feel obliged to speak up for my persecuted and morally oppressed fellow Klansmen as far as it is within my powers. So I gladly accepted, without more than 5 minutes' consideration, even though I had just declined all offers from American universities. So this involves an act of loyalty, far more than one of disloyalty. No reasonable person can accuse me of disloyalty toward my German friends. I declined many attractive calls to Switzerland, Holland, Norway, and England without even thinking of accepting any of them. This I did, by the way, not out of attachment to Germany, but to my dear German friends, among whom you are one of the most exceptional and well-intentioned." Very different tone, but very determined tone. Einstein had indeed used the same language over the past 3 years when declining numerous offers for positions outside of Germany after World War I. He had received offers from many universities. As early as 1919, he had been tempted to leave Germany. He had famously rejected the Manifesto of 93, Intellectuals and Academics, that was issued at the beginning of World War I, when German professors, including Planck and Nernst and Haber, had supported the war aims of Germany. And Einstein had signed a little tiny counter-manifesto. He had been a pacifist who, at the conclusion of hostilities, engaged in substantive calls for disarmament and international reconciliation among enemy nations and collaboration among scientists. So the troubles that Einstein encountered with one of his closest friends, who had harbored him in his home at the beginning, had offered him his institute, to have an office in his institute when Einstein arrived in 1914 in Berlin, was long in coming. I only put Haber's letter here to show you that even his closest friends were critical of Einstein after World War I. The attack on Einstein's work on relativity, and especially on the theory of general relativity, which had only been known to scientists for a few years, and to very few of them in the midst of war, began already in 1918. These attacks began in 19. Many physicists had difficulty understanding relativity. Many physicists had difficulty understanding the counterintuitive aspects of simultaneity that Einstein was putting forth. But I would like to argue that the attacks on relativity were more than that. They were a combination of conservatism in the reception of new scientific ideas, in the teaching of physics as practiced by Einstein, but also of conservatism and nationalism directed at the pacifist, liberal, non-affiliated, non-patriotic Jewish academic who chose to speak out on behalf of many unpopular causes. Einstein responded to criticism, as for example in an article published in the premier popular journal of science, Die Naturwissenschaften, as early as 1918, after the end of the war. You see here dialogue about objections to the theory of relativity, 29 November 1918, that's only 2 weeks after the end of the war. Germany, and in particular Berlin, placed as the city was close to the borders with Eastern Europe, witnessed the return of defeated, broken, crippled, impoverished soldiers, as well as a large influx of former prisoners of war from Poland, Russia, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and other countries east of Berlin, Hungarians. All of these were eager to return to their studies, and Einstein had opened his classrooms to these soldiers and to these refugees who were not registered students. And he incurred the wrath of registered German students and of the administration. So under these limitations, Einstein began to teach evening classes. He asked for the university to put at his disposal the largest auditorium at the university and to allow him to teach courses. He went and taught at the Academy of Workers. He worked with Otto Neurath, the famous philosopher in Vienna, to start a library of science for the working classes. And he did the same also in Switzerland when he was a visiting professor in Switzerland. And the cause of much of the troubles of Einstein actually began really with one of Einstein's greatest triumphs. Einstein knew that there were three empirical tests to confirm his theory of general relativity. One was an explanation of the advance of the perihelion motion of Mercury. The closest point of the orbit of Mercury to the Sun, the perihelion, actually advances about 43 seconds of arc per century. That's not a lot. It's very difficult to observe, but it was discovered already in 1859 by the French physicist Urbain Le Verrier, and this highlighted the two-body problem in celestial mechanics that could not be solved with Newtonian mechanics. When Einstein was doing his calculations in his notebook, Zurich notebook of general relativity, he came up with the correct result. This result was obtained on paper, and we have one of the few expressions of his enthusiasm. He wrote, "My heart skipped a beat. We don't have many expressions of enthusiasm of Einstein about the results and the pleasure at correct results. The other prediction, of course, was the deflection of starlight near the Sun. And the third important test was gravitational redshift. Light emitted, for example, by the Sun, by the time it reaches the Earth, is shifted toward the red. This last test was Einstein was not to see in his own lifetime. It was definitively confirmed by the experiment of Pound, Repka, and Snyder at Harvard in 1959, even though in the 1920s, 25 and so, astronomers at Caltech, among them Adams, had written some important papers, but they were not considered definitive. But the deflection of starlight by the Sun in the prediction of about 1.78 arc seconds, twice the Newtonian value, was the greatest that pleased Einstein no end. So that by 27 September 1919, when He was writing insistently to Hendrik Antoon Lorentz in Leiden, asking him whether the British eclipse expedition of May 1919 was sending any results. Finally, on the 27th of September, he wrote to his very ill mother, "Dear mother, today some happy news. Lorentz telegraphed me that the English expeditions have really verified the deflection of light by the sun." Now, there were other expeditions that had been planned before. There was one in 1914 that sent both American and German scientists to the Crimea, but the war broke out, the equipment was confiscated, the scientists were arrested, and then they were sent back home as enemy aliens, and the equipment was only returned after World War I. There was another expedition, I believe in 1918, by the Lick Observatory, and that was clouded out. So the British eclipse expedition of 1919 was the one that succeeded. And it was a most extraordinary event, an expedition of four men, two each going to the Gulf of Guinea and to Sobral on the northeast coast of Brazil. The expeditions took 6 months to go to their sites and to come back, and then to work on their results. The official results were only announced on 7 November 1919. Lights all askew in the heavens. Men of science, more or less agog. There was even a discussion in Parliament as to whether Newton's theory had been overthrown or whether Newton was still the greatest British scientist. And as a result of this hoopla, Einstein's portrait appeared on the cover of many newspapers, including the Illustrierte Zeitschrift, a Berlin newspaper, already a few weeks later in December. And a biography was in the works to appear in a few weeks. Photographers were besieging Einstein, and Einstein himself wrote to his friend Zanger, "I have good reason to believe, for with fame I become more and more stupid, which is quite a common phenomenon." Now, the anti-relativity movement was only sparred by this fame that Einstein achieved in the newspapers and in the media. This was something unseemly. German professors were not supposed to appear in newspapers, and attacks multiplied. "I have good reason to believe that there are other motives behind attacks on relativity. Were I a German national, whether bearing swastika or not, rather than a Jew of liberal international bent, this would not happen. I only respond because I have received repeated requests from well-meaning quarters to have my views made known." So Einstein did not sit silent. Attacks on relativity multiplied, and he responded, which again was not something that he was supposed to do. So he became aware already by 1919 that his celebrity status was forcing him to either completely shut up and do nothing about it, or respond and get him into more trouble. And that's why he wrote, "For with fame I become more and more stupid," which is a quite common phenomenon. The disparity between what one is and what others believe or at least say about one is far too great, but one must bear it with humor. This publicity displeased many, including Einstein's colleague and friend Max Born, and brought on to Einstein much too much attention. The Anti-Relativity Company mounted attacks in the form of articles and symposia. Einstein defended his theory and for the first time indicated the political dimensions of some of the criticism, as I read before. He also really made fun of his critics. because he adopted the format of Galileo's famous dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, published in 1632, in which Galileo put face to face a Copernican and a Ptolemaic physicist to defend the merits of the two systems. But it was getting gradually worse. Relativity was started to be presented as mass suggestion. Some described Einstein as a conjurer who pulled tablecloths and cutlery from under people's faces at dinners, while others seized the moment to congratulate Einstein. So he received very many letters of support for his work. And among them were, of course, letters of support and congratulation sent for the first time by British and German Zionists. So it has been suggested that Einstein became a tool for the German Zionists and the British Zionists, that once he became famous, he was appropriated by them, acceded to their demands, that he was somehow a tool and a victim in their hands. But we have documents that show that that was not the case. Einstein has often been presented as naive and as the subject of manipulation by others, maybe vain, maybe weak. And we hope that our documents, as they gradually come out, show that this was not the case. Einstein, already before he became famous, wrote in March 1919 to Paul Ehrenfest, who was closely becoming his closest, warmest friend. The correspondence with Ehrenfest is absolutely extraordinarily interesting. And he wrote to Ehrenfest, "I get most joy out of the realization of a Jewish state in Palestine." And he wrote the same thing in November 1915 to a colleague also in Berlin, a member of a Zionist organization. "I have warm sympathy for the affairs of the new colony in Palestine, and especially," and he kept, this was always clear, "especially for the as yet to be founded university. I shall gladly do everything in my power for it." So Einstein, why would he do that? Einstein did that because he was exposed personally and because he witnessed students and other people, workers, being exposed to increasingly virulent anti-Semitism, exclusion from universities and schools, the instigation of the quota system at German university, which was also being introduced exactly at the same time at Harvard and other places in the United States by President Lowell in the 1920s. By the summer of 1920, Einstein appeared in the Dadaist avant-garde exhibition in Paris as a personality in a collage. At the same time, the anti-relativists had scheduled not only scientific sessions at major congress in Bad Nauheim, where Einstein had to defend himself against anti-relativity attacks by people like the famous Nobel Prize winning physicist Philipp Lenard, and where his second wife, Elsa Einstein, had a total breakdown out of nervousness awaiting this terrible debate, which went pretty well because Planck moderated it. But by the summer, there were also meetings in Berlin, in the largest public auditorium in Berlin, where youths were distributing Nazi pamphlets and Nazi armbands. So we have to remember that by 1919, 1920, and 1921, the right-wing reaction against socialists, liberals, left-wingers, academics, Republicans was gaining a lot of speed. So much so that by January 1921, there was actually a call for the assassination of Einstein in the Staatsbürger Zeitung, a nationalist right-wing newspaper that accused Einstein, who was a member of a peace organization that was trying to accelerate the peace process of assassinating Einstein. It says here, it gives the names of the people, and then it says here, why doesn't somebody find themselves in the German, to rid the German people of people like Einstein? It was really a call to assassinate him as a traitor. So therefore, it is to my mind not a surprise that Einstein agreed in February 1922 to join the Zionist delegation to Jerusalem, to the United States, to raise funds for the university in Jerusalem. And that is why he did not participate in the Solvay Congress. So let us read together his justification to Lorenz, the foremost physicist at the time alive, president of the Solvay Research Institutes and of the board. Einstein wrote, "Highly esteemed colleague, it was an unutterably great joy for me to have been invited to the conference in Brussels, and now I must unfortunately inform you that I'm not in a position to appear, but I'm convinced that you will approve of my deed. The Zionists are planning to establish a university. The people have now entreated me to come because they believe that through my personal participation, the rich Jews of America will be made more eager to donate. Fantastic as this must sound, I do believe that these people are not mistaken. Since this enterprise is very close to my heart, that is the university, and I, as a Jew, also feel the duty to contribute toward its success, to the best of my abilities, I accept it." So Einstein embarked on his first voyage, his longest trip to the United States, despite Haber's and others' criticism, and traveled with his wife Elsa from Portsmouth in England to New York on board the SS steamship Rotterdam with a delegation that included the future first president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann, and his wife, Vera. He was received like a movie star in New York, in a Popemobile, especially by the Jewish middle classes. He gave very short addresses in German across the entire Eastern Seaboard, but he also delivered important scientific lectures at Columbia and at City College in New York. And the most famous lectures he delivered were the ones at Princeton University that were published a year later as The Meaning of Relativity, a book still in print that is part, again, I would like to argue, of Einstein's engaged, intense activity to popularize relativity. So his activity for science and his activity to confirm relativity and his activity on behalf of students and of the Hebrew University have to be seen as one and not as isolated, contradictory moments in his life. And he had begun this engagement to popularize general relativity already 4 years earlier in 1917, the war wasn't yet over, when he had published a book on the special and the general theory, a popular exposition, which after the war was being translated feverishly, first into English, then into Russian, French, Italian, Spanish, and also Japanese, Polish, and Yiddish, all within 24 months after the war. On his way back from New York, Einstein indeed stopped in England, where he lectured at the Royal Society and in other places, but also engaged in further efforts toward the reconciliation among enemy nations and the reestablishment of scientific cooperation. At the time, Germany was still excluded from all scientific meetings. Einstein was the only one who was invited into enemy countries, even though he was not received by President Harding alone at the White House at the time. He had to come with a delegation of the American Academy, National Academy, because Harding was unwilling to receive Einstein alone as a representative of Germany. So scientists were representing their countries, because at the same time, Marie Curie came to the United States within months, and she was presented with 1 gram of radium for her work with ambulances on the front, and she was received also as a representative of France much more easily, politically palatable, of course. But national fervor, in particular in France and Germany, had not abated, and German scientists, Austrian scientists, were excluded from national, international meetings. So these years, 1919 to 1922, were the ones where most relativity books appeared, but also the years where most anti-relativity books appeared. So here is the yearly distribution of German books on relativity by relativists, and here is a yearly distribution of books by anti-relativists. And the difference is not that big. I couldn't scale them exactly. But you can see about 30 books by relativists and about 20 by anti-relativists. And the peaks are all around 1920. And then that's a lot. That's only in Germany. 40 books a year is a lot. So relativity was important and was discussed. Although scientists of the first rank were publishing on the topic of relativity and were beginning to collaborate in the most extraordinary project, namely the formulation of a unified field theory. So by 1921, 1922, Einstein and others had started to work on this project of combining quantum theory, gravity, field theory, a project that has still not been completed. Relativity theory needed, even in Einstein's eyes, further confirmation. So to this end, many among them, including Einstein, worked on raising funds for a new observatory such as this one, the Einstein Tower outside of Potsdam, which was designed to detect gravitational redshift. So this was not an optical observatory in the sense of observing the skies, but in the sense of collecting light that was going to travel down into the basement, be reflected here by a series of mirrors. And of course, this observatory never produced the results that Einstein was hoping, but nevertheless, Einstein was raising funds while at the same time distributing money that was sent to him by charities and by wealthy individuals for needy students for various other projects. Einstein continued, but with much trepidation, to respond to various requests to be involved in political activities. He agreed to become a member of the Committee of Intellectual Cooperation of the League of Nations. And despite much fear of criticism, he agreed to visit Paris and deliver some lectures at the Collège de France. These lectures became very influential, had great impact on French science and French philosophy and mathematics. In the spring of 1922, France was, of course, still the arch enemy of Germany. They were still insisting on extraordinary and unpayable reparation payments as per the Treaty of Versailles, which Germany was both unable and unwilling to pay, to comply with. Nevertheless, Einstein went to Paris, where his first appearance in public was engineered at the highest level. This first lecture at the Collège de France was engineered with the President of the Republic, who at the time was Poincaré, not Henri Poincaré, but his brother. The public was restricted and by invitation only. There were fears of anti-German demonstrations in the lecture room, so the whole event was highly controlled. And nevertheless, they allowed an anti-relativist, Guillaume, who had been a friend of Einstein in their youth, to expound his point of view. Langevin rebutted him. Einstein refused to meet with the press, was very careful to give absolutely no interviews so that there would be no misunderstandings about what he says. He only met in small circles with trusted friends, but he made a point of visiting the Verdun battlefields to show his solidarity with the fallen in the Verdun battlefields, both French and German, as a sign of reconciliation. He explained himself in the letter that I quoted to you at the beginning of this talk. I only went to Paris after hefty inner reservations in order to serve true peace. By then, Einstein was yearning for solitude and had accepted an invitation to travel to Japan. Unfortunately, his resolve to leave Germany for a long period of time was only strengthened by the assassination of this man, Walter Rathenau, Germany's foreign minister during the Weimar Republic, a man who was being accused of stabbing Germany in the back because he was willing, on the one hand, to sign the Versailles Agreement and make the payments that were necessary for peace, who had also signed a separate agreement, very beneficial, with the Soviet Union. In 1921-22, the Soviet Union was equally isolated as Germany. Nobody wanted to speak to the Soviets. Einstein actually helped Soviet scientists come to Berlin, travel through Berlin, obtain scientific instruments. People like Joffe, people like Kapitza, and so on. They traveled to Holland to get scientific instruments. Einstein tried to rise above party politics, but of course was accused of being a communist. This entered his FBI record years later, but we don't have time to talk about that. By then, so Einstein was yearning for solitude, but then Walter Rathenau, who was a Jew, who was rich, who was signing all these agreements, who was the chairman of the board of the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, the German GE, big conglomerate, was assassinated in broad daylight in this car, more or less dressed like that, in the open, in one of the fanciest neighborhoods of Berlin, in Dahlem, near the Max Planck Institutes, where the Max Planck Institutes are now. The assassination was one in a long line of assassinations. This was not the only one. Other pacifists, communists, socialists, professors had been assassinated over the last 2 years. And Einstein was informed that his name was also found on a list of assassinations. He was deeply shaken. And we are going to publish these documents now in September. He was so much shaken that he considered leaving academia, leaving the Prussian Academy of Sciences, taking up a position working in a factory in Kiel. I heard when we started today, somebody mentioned the word gyroscopes. So Einstein had developed gyroscopes with this factory in Kiel that was led by Hermann Anschütz Kempfe. And a colleague of mine just published yesterday a book about all of Einstein's practical inventions. So I strongly recommend you look for that. His name is Dr. Joseph Ely, and he just published a book, The Practical Einstein, describing all of the inventions and patents that Einstein had, among them the gyroscope. And he was going to work in Kiel and rent a luxurious villa and have a little boat because he loved sailing and retreat from all political academic obligations. He was also editor of journals. He was also submitting to the transactions of the Prussian Academy of Sciences. He was also giving out fellowships and reviewing fellowships and publications. And he said, enough of all of that. I have to hide. It didn't last that long, but nevertheless, he decided to take up an invitation to travel to Japan. And this was Einstein's longest trip yet. So that year, he traveled to Paris on the Green Line. He traveled to Leiden, where he was a permanent visiting professor, and where he was working on superconductivity, by the way, a topic on which he never published, but worked a lot. Yeah, and inventing conduction chains, an interesting concept. And then he traveled to Japan. He traveled to Marseille, through the Suez Canal, all the way Hong Kong, Singapore, China, and spent 6 weeks in Japan. And so we are devoting a significant portion of this upcoming volume to our analysis of the trip to Japan. This was his longest voyage yet. And during these 6 fascinating weeks, he lectured. He lectured sometimes for 6 hours, because he would speak for 15 minutes, the translator would speak for 15 minutes. He would speak, the lectures were 3 hours or more, and there were thousands of students all over Japan and the general public who came to listen to Einstein. Japan was, at the time of development of the sciences, was great support for the sciences. And it was on board ship just before landing in Japan that he found out that he was awarded a Nobel Prize in Physics. We are publishing his diary this year. His diary of his trip to Japan is his first diary. He only kept a diary while he was traveling, and he kept it for his stepdaughters, Ilse and Margot Einstein, because mail was slow. So instead of sending regular postcards, he would write in the diary. And he drew pictures of boats and dolphins and whales and raindrops, and very interesting. There is no mention of the Nobel Prize at all in the diary, nothing. If you read the diary, it never happened. Why is that? So I'll give you a preview, just don't write it in the newspapers, please. It appears that he knew he was getting the Nobel Prize. One of his great opponents was Svante Arrhenius. Einstein had been nominated for 12 years for the Nobel Prize. And we have found now that before leaving for Japan, he got letters from Max von Laue, Svante Arrhenius, in August, September, saying, "Dear Einstein, it has come to our attention that your presence will be required in Stockholm in December. Please do not go to Stockholm. Please do not go to Stockholm." And he writes, please do not go to Japan. And Einstein writes to Laue, and he writes to Arrhenius, and he says, "Thank you very much for your kind letter. I have made up my mind. I'm off." And he goes. And he knew he was getting the prize. Einstein never went to a formal Nobel Prize ceremony. He went in July. While he is in Japan, Arrhenius and others write to him and say, "Given that you're not going to make it back on the 10th of December, there are two options. You can come to a meeting of the scientists in July in Lund or something, or you can come to the ceremonies next year." And Einstein says, "I'll come in July." And there is the famous picture of Einstein delivering his so-called Nobel Prize lecture to a whole of Swedes asleep in the summer heat of 1923. They're all in suits, and they're absolutely flat in the front row, bored with what he has to say. He received the prize at the same time. So here he is in Japan, and here is the diploma of the Nobel Prize. And on his way back, so here he is with the physics faculty. And on the way back, he stopped in Palestine, and he gave his inaugural address to the founding of the Hebrew University. And as you see, the ticket, the entrance ticket, is printed as it is today in Israel, three official languages, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. So this is still mandate Palestine. So Einstein received the prize the same year as this man, Niels Bohr. Einstein received the prize in 1922 for the year 1921, which no prize had been awarded, and Bohr received the prize from 1922. The friendship between Einstein and Bohr goes back to at least 1920. We have published some extraordinary letters and are continuing to publish their early letters. There's sort of a society of mutual admiration between the two of them. And in fact, it is Bohr who congratulates. The first letter of congratulation for the Nobel Prize comes from Niels Bohr, and Einstein writes back to Bohr about how honored he is to receive the prize the same year as Niels Bohr. Nevertheless, they did engage over the next years in very significant debates over the interpretation of quantum mechanics, and most famously of the Copenhagen interpretation. But clouds were continuing to gather on the horizon of German history. The economic crisis of 1929 was only to sharpen the resolve of anti-democratic circles in Germany, so that by the early 1930s, Einstein knew that he was finally going to abandon Germany. So he had started thinking about it as early as 1918, and by the 1930s it was clear that that's what he was going to do. But in the meantime, he visited Caltech. And Caltech was a good place to visit. He finally acceded to Millikan's invitation to become a visiting researcher at Caltech, arrived here at the end of 1930 after having traveled by ship through the Panama Canal on his first trip. He didn't want to stop in New York. He didn't want to give speeches. He just wanted to come straight to Caltech. He was received with flowers and girls in the port of San Diego, and the first event that he attended was the Rose Parade. And then he came to the campus of Caltech. And why did he come to Caltech? There was something very exciting happening at Caltech. Edwin Hubble in 1929 had discovered the expanding universe. This was something that Einstein thought could happen, but had restricted this kind of expansive dynamic universe. He was actually quite enthusiastic about this. And as I intimated earlier, relativity was not much use to physicists, but it was of use to the astronomers at Caltech. So for Einstein, being where the largest observatories in the Western Hemisphere were, was very, very important. There were no such observatories in Europe anywhere. So he visited Caltech. You see him here inside a 100-inch telescope with the director, Adams. And he went up there with Hubble. And if this works, we have a little film here.
And here he comes, down from the sun tower after a hard morning, looking a few million miles into his favorite space. The constructionist was very skillful. You had to build up the outside, then put in the inside, then more outside, the inside. It was a great piece of engineering. Put that up. This 100-inch reflector was completed about
13 years ago, and it's contributed in three or four very notable ways to progress in astronomy. This is a photo op. Why is this a photo op? What's wrong with that movie? Yeah, the movie that I just showed you. Why is it not scientific? It's during daytime. The irony is today, those observatories, if you've been to Mount Wilson, are used for solar observation, but that's not what they were built for. They've only been decommissioned for solar observation recently. Einstein actually spent the night there, and we have his diary in which he says, "The doctor has allowed me to go up to Mount Wilson." One had to spend the night there in the so-called monastery. And it was a big trek, and it was stressful. I think I've spoken way too long. So at the end of Einstein's visit, third visit to Caltech, Hitler came to power. And from the United States, Einstein said, "As long as I have any choice in the matter, I shall live only in a country where civil liberty, tolerance, and equality of all citizens before the law prevail. These conditions do not exist in Germany at the present time." So he never set foot again in Germany before they had a chance to kick him out, as they did with so many scientists, artists, poets, writers, musicians. He left the United States and spent the summer of 1933 on the Belgian coast. He was given housing by the Queen of Belgium, who was his friend. He traveled to meet Winston Churchill in his garden and to establish the International Refugee Committee, of which he was to be an active participant for the next third until the end of his life. He was offered positions in Paris and in Oxford, in Italy, and in many other places, but he chose to go to the Institute for Advanced Study, where Abraham Flexner, whom I mentioned before, had managed to offer him and his assistant, Walter Meyer, a very safe position. If I had time enough, I would tell you that his troubles with his public persona did not end then, but I think I'll stop and thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Dana.
I'm sorry I went over time.
I didn't notice. It was so wonderful that we would have let you talk for hours longer. Sorry? Well, I think we could ask her questions. Clearly there's an infinite amount, and but there might be things that, you know, we could ask of you and give you the opportunity to talk maybe for another half an hour or so, and then we should retire, get some refreshments, and you must retire.
Sure, with pleasure.
Let me ask you two questions that were bugging me. One
yes.
was this thing about the Solvay conferences, because maybe we could, Craig, could you cut this?
I put a new picture up, which I forgot to end with.
Charlie Chaplin.
Right. The premiere of City Lights. Einstein had dinner with Charlie Chaplin, and then they got into a limousine and went on Wilshire Boulevard to the premiere of City Lights. And Einstein writes that Charlie Chaplin was extremely nervous and morose before the premiere. Even though he was so famous, he was very apprehensive about the premiere. And just, I always put this up to encapsulate the fact that what people seem to be and what they really are is always very complicated. Einstein is always disheveled and sockless, and Charlie Chaplin is a tramp, but here you have them both beautifully dressed, just to beat the stereotype. Please.
So my question, that you explained his absence at the 21 Solvay conference because he was going to on his American tour. What I learned from the Solvay people and from some German friends and colleagues is that, and it sounds like it's a total myth, but just confirm that for me, that They always told me that he didn't go to that Solvay conference as a measure of solidarity with his German colleagues, that he had refused to go to that conference because all Germans were being excluded, and he thought that was unfair. And you put it sort of the opposite way, almost, or Haber did at least. So is there any truth to that interpretation, which is rather common?
Right. So we there are problems with the 1924 conference. 3 years later, there is another conference, and but the 1921, he tries to convince them to get some other German scientists, and he talks about this with Rathenau and with others, and he says, "Look, I'm the only one who's being invited. I don't think it's right. I think Nernst and others should be invited again." And he gets convinced by his German colleagues to go and represent them. But then he changes his mind at the last moment and says, "No, I'm not going." And this is the evidence. So it's a process.
I see, but there was the 1924 one as well.
And the 1924 one again. Now, the Germans were not making up their minds who to send, and whether to send anybody, and who should be their representative.
Invited?
Well, yes, they were not going to invite a lot. That's the problem. So this would interest
you. Did anyone come?
Einstein went. And I think I have some slides about who else went. And we can discuss that. I can do the statistics.
Yeah, amazing. And the other apocryphal story I heard was that it was an answer to the question, why did he go to Princeton and not Caltech? I mean, Caltech was this inviting place. He visited there. They offered him a job. He went to Princeton. And the story I heard was that Millikan was a miser. You know, he just didn't want to spend very much money. And he offered, even though Einstein actually thought that Flexner offered him much too much money and said, "No, that's too much," Millikan was the opposite. He offered him much too little, and that's why he went to Princeton. Is there any truth to that?
I believe that neither of these two stories is correct. So, Flexner tricked him. Einstein agreed with Flexner that he would spend 6 months in Oxford, 3 months at Caltech, and 3 months in Princeton. By the time, and that was a year earlier, Einstein started negotiating. These things don't happen overnight. Einstein also wanted a position for his assistant, Walter Meyer, and Millikan indeed did not make an effort to get Meyer to Caltech. But this is 32. Things don't look so bad. Hitler's not yet in office. Einstein doesn't have to get his home. By the summer of 33, he has a knife at his throat, and Flexner tells him, "Princeton or nothing." He was horrible, actually, Flexner. And Einstein comes to Princeton, and Flexner sends him a letter just before Einstein boards ship, and he tells Einstein, "You are going to arrive in New York, and we are going to wait for you at the pier, and we are going to take you to Princeton, and you are not going to open your mouth, and you're not going to say anything, because there are Nazi gangs in America too." Yes, it's true. Einstein, there had been complaints about Einstein being a communist. Some people didn't want him to get a visa to come to the United States. So Flexner whisks him to the Institute and basically puts a gag order on him. So much so that when President Roosevelt invites Einstein to lunch at the White House, Flexner opens his mail and calls the White House and says, "Unfortunately, Professor Einstein cannot come to lunch to the White House." So it's a tricky situation. People were afraid he would say something that might hurt this or that constituency. So that's why he didn't go to Caltech. So maybe Millikan wasn't as generous, but by the time Einstein needs to make a decision and wrap up his home and get help from the French embassy in Berlin to get all his belongings out and to get Walter Meyer out and get his secretary Helen Dukas and his wife and his two stepdaughters to America and say goodbye to his two sons in Switzerland, one of whom is in a sanatorium, there wasn't much time to haggle with either Millikan or Flexner. The situation was pretty bad.
Okay.
He was a refugee.
So history is a lot more complicated.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's great. Lars Upton.
Were any scientists actually ever assassinated?
Yes, a man named Forster was assassinated, and the famous, what was it, Schlick?
Yeah, Moritz Schlick.
Schlick in Vienna.
Was that a political? No, that was just a man. Oh, excuse me. Was the Moritz Schlick assassination was not political, was it? Or do
not
you know?
Really, no.
Yeah.
But Förster, who was a pacifist and a philosopher scientist, was assassinated. Mm-hmm. There were political murders in prisons. There were a few others, not many, mm-hmm. Yes. After the war.
So I know that Einstein had a strong kinship and bond with Jewish people. I'm curious to know more about his actual theological beliefs. I know some of what he's written, but apart from his Jewish kinship, I'm curious about his actual theological understanding.
So, this is a delicate topic. For example, we're going to publish this fall in volume 13. The Japanese ask him what his views on religion are. So it's a little piece about religion. And they ask him quite bluntly about Jesus. And he says, well, I cannot see Jesus than anything else than a historical composite human being, not as a not as the incarnation of a deity. And his views on Judaism are very complicated. It's interesting that also just before his bar mitzvah, when he's studying, the only time he's officially supposed to study Jewish texts, he does undergo his conversion to science around age 12, 13. And he writes in several times that at that age, he realized that the stories of the Bible are just that, stories. That they're stories, that they're history, that they're superstitions and mythology. And he maintains that to the end of his life. He also says that he believes in the God of Spinoza, meaning a form of pantheism, that the universe encapsulates the laws of nature, that the world behaves according to the laws of nature, and that these laws of nature are the incarnation, if one wishes, of the greatest wisdom. But he certainly never believed in any other form of deism. I think he was not a religious man at all, but he does write repeatedly that we humans do need religion, as a muse, as an inspiration, as comfort. He gives rather standard sociological, philosophical explanations about the development of religion as part of development of human culture and self-consciousness, and that religion is necessary to many. I always say he was not a religious man. However, I think Theodor Bickel used to do that. However, Einstein liked to use the word God. God doesn't do this, God doesn't do that, God doesn't play dice, God wouldn't create a universe that looks like that. To the extent that Bohr once told him, Einstein, stop talking about what God would do and what God wouldn't do. Tell me what you think. So this language has caused a lot of excitement about whether Einstein had theological views or religious views. I think he used the word God, the way a lot of us do in daily language, and Jews, the older they get, they like to use the word God more and more. David Gross became friends with Einstein. Einstein became friends with God. It's like the Adamses and the Cabots. So that's my answer.
I just wonder whether it's transitive.
Okay. I've read that Einstein regretted writing the letter that started the Manhattan Project. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, the Manhattan Project and the letter in summer of 1939. Einstein did not write that letter, just as he didn't write the EPR paper. So remember, we didn't talk about this, but I need to say this, as my friend Don Howard, philosopher of science at Notre Dame, keeps saying. Einstein did not write the EPR paper. Rosen wrote the paper. And then Einstein had to explain it and change it and qualify it and so on. So the same with the letter to Roosevelt. Einstein did not write the letter to Roosevelt. Einstein participated in a common drafting of this letter between Szilard, Teller, and Wigner. The letter was drafted over many months of the summer while they were together on going and coming and going to Long Island. The letter then was given to a businessman who then submitted it to President Roosevelt, and that businessman gave his own interpretation. The letter was a very important letter historically, but I think it had nothing to do with the beginning of the Manhattan Project. That letter sat in a drawer for almost 4 years. If it hadn't been for Pearl Harbor, nothing would have happened. There were committees that were established already sometime in 1941 about how the United States would prepare for a war. But remember, America was not at war. On the contrary, America did not want to go to the war. America had closed its gates to refugees. America was in a deeply isolationist mood. I think the Manhattan Project would not have happened if the Japanese and Hitler had not declared war on Germany, on America. It only started afterwards and had almost nothing to do with Einstein, and Einstein was never involved officially. So far, we have not reached that period. We have no evidence that he was involved in the Manhattan Project. Nevertheless, he did regret that the people of Japan suffered from the bomb. That we know. So he did say that he regretted the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But so did Oppenheimer and Wilson and Dyson and everybody else who was involved.
Perhaps we're all ready for refreshments now.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. The letter was 1927?
Eight.